Now, Joan Bakewell became a TV star in the 60s when a programme called Late Night Lineup appeared in the schedules of BBC Two. It dominated the nation's conversations as anybody who was anybody turned up to be interviewed. Since then, she's never been far from the public eye, both as a writer and presenter, and most recently as the inspiration for Harold Pinter's play Betrayal. Her autobiography is called The Centre of the Bed. Why the title, The Centre of the Bed, Joan?
The story is based on a conceit in that I saw a Renaissance painting when I was a child of the vision of St. Ursula. An angel had entered her room, a fictitious angel in her dream, of course, and given her the vision that she would one day be a virgin martyr. I looked at the picture of this virgin martyr, and she was lying on one side of the bed, thus setting up the proposition that she expected her life to be about sharing her life. And I thought, she's a virgin martyr, why she can have the centre of the bed? And I thought, it sort of it encapsulates the options that we have. We can share our lives, or we can, and people are increasingly doing, moving to the centre of the life, their own lives. And that particularly applies to women.
You write at the beginning of the book, very movingly, about your mother's depression. Why do you think depression so afflicted her?
I think I'm finding, as I talk to many, many women, that a whole generation of my mother's age, who was born in 1903, did suffer depression. And I wondered why. At the time, of course, it was a very cruel experience for a young girl to have a mother who was silent a good deal of the time. But looking back at her times in which she grew up, I'd uncovered, of course, the fact that Manchester was the cradle of the suffragette movement, and that there must have been quite a noisy discussion then about the role of women. And I wondered whether she, as a 13-year-old, forced to leave school at 13 to earn some money, had looked to her times to give her opportunities. And she did. She studied engineering. But when the moment she married, she became a wife and mother, and was, in a sense, that was her destiny. And I speculate that perhaps this generation of women suffered depression because their hopes, aspirations weren't fulfilled.
How did you stop yourself, though, being resentful of her smacks and her put-downs?
Well, of course, I was very angry, but I knew that anger was no use because it would simply increase the antagonism in the household. And we were a very discreet, well-behaved household. And I felt that the best thing was to try and be useful in this situation and resolve it. So as anyone who lives with a depressive knows, you kind of tiptoe around the situation and learn to tell when something awful is about to descend. And that was of more practical use. And I'm quite a practical person. And I thought that would save us all more pain.
Now, you were the first to Cambridge from your Stockport Girls' Grammar School, the first in your family to university at all. And then as soon as you graduated, you got married and had children, just like your mum had. Why?
Well, you know, that also was something that swept my generation. I mean, as I unfolded my life, I realised how typical it is of a woman's life in the 20th century. In fact, that could be the subtext of my book. What happens after a war, the men all come home, and although women, the enlightened women, want to hold on to the new roles they've got, basically there is a nest-building era that follows wars, because you've been out there fighting for your family and you come home and you want to invest in your family. So there was a great spirit that spread after the war, 1945 it finished, and for about a decade there followed this feeling that home and family was it. Advertising led in this, the woman in the pinny and the man mending the car. The whole culture was geared to that, and I swallowed it. But also at Cambridge, there was this sense, we were all great admirers of D.H. Lawrence with his idea of the great sensual, erotic bond between men and women. And we wanted that too. That was new. And that was fighting the repression of the early generation. So that was matched with the homemaking. It was only in the early 60s that we began to realise that that was rather arid, really. It wasn't enough. And a whole generation of women who'd been to university and found themselves locked at home, you know, changing nappies, contacted each other. It was basically the Guardian's women's page and said, is this why we got degrees? Is that why we had this incredible education?
So how hard did you have to push to get the job that you got?
Oh, hard. Hard. When young people say, tell me how to get on in the media, I say persistence, number one, and the strength of determination, that's hard. I used to read the Radio Times and list all the producers, and then I would write to them all great batches of letters, and most of them would write back the formal reply. Anyone who gave me an inch of hope was filed away, and I wrote again 3 months later.
And what was the atmosphere like on Line Up?
Oh, Line Up was giddy. Line Up was the most intellectually open opportunity I've known in any broadcasting situation. We were allowed to think up ideas for themselves, and we were allowed to make last-minute decisions which didn't have to be approved by hierarchies of people. We were interested in radical new ideas. We were quite a mixed bunch of people. Someone was interested in sports, someone in jazz, someone in poetry. A lot of poetry on the programme, but also with Jimi Hendrix and people like that. So it had enormous intellectual freedom at a time when ideas were in a ferment in the 60s, and of course we brought them all into the studio.
Now, it's taken me a long time to mention that that phrase, the thinking man's crumpet.
Yes, well, it came with the territory.
It must have infuriated you.
It was very strange. I thought it was just an aside that would die away, and it's been absolutely branded on me ever since. Some women say, for heaven's sake, be grateful. You know, it could have been worse. It's a wonderful. Well, many of us would like to be so-called. But
you deconstruct it in the book as an entirely male construction.
Well, you see, the thinking man gets the credit for the thinking. And the crumpet, he gets the credit for the crumpet. You know, where's the gain for the woman in here being his object? So with some good humour, I accepted it and thought it'll go away. And it didn't go away. And there was just a brief span when feminism was really very strong and strident, some of it, when a group of feminists cornered me at a public protest meeting, you know, for the rights of women, and said, you shouldn't be here. You're trivial. You're frivolous.
How did you respond to that?
Well, I said, no, I'm not trivial. I've been trivialised. But nonetheless, they didn't go with me on that. Because the other thing, of course, is I do enjoy men and men's company, and I did like wearing short skirts. But we all did, and had long hair, we all did. I loved all the fashions of the 60s, and they wanted me to give all that up.
Now, you have written in the book about the long affair with Harold Pinter, and there was a recent headline called you the thinking man's strumpet. How did you react to that?
Well, I thought that was an absolutely staggering thing to do. I thought it was outrageous, completely outrageous, because, I mean, strumpet is a real term of abuse, and it suggests a sort of promiscuity of lifestyle that has never been any part of my life, ever, or even my thinking. I thought it was a cheap, cheap male joke, and probably not worth the candle. I think it probably brought me more sympathetic responses from friends who said, I'm outraged at that. And, well, I felt it was a bit of a spoiler, really, on the part of the newspaper involved.
Now, Pinter was quoted as saying that he felt sick that you'd chronicled the affair. What was your reaction to that after he had talked about you in his biography?
I think what makes him sick, and I can understand this, is that he does hate the media focusing on it so much, and him being hounded and asked all the time, for which I'm sorry, that what does he think about it? And he's sick of being asked what he thinks about it. Of course, it was because of Harold's invitation to me to talk to his biographer, Michael Billington, that the whole thing came out at all, because I did say to Harold, what do I say to him? And Harold said, tell him the truth. Tell him the truth. It's time to tell him the truth, because this is all decades old. And so the story came out in a serious biography, which set it in place in Harold's life. And in my autobiography, I've set it in place in my life.
You write about him rather more than either of your two husbands. And I came away from that book thinking he was the love of her life, was he?
Well, it was, of course, a very intense relationship, but it was also the part of my life that again reflected how women were in those days and how they were confused about their emotions. Some of them, I mean, heaven knows, plenty weren't, but it was a time in the 60s of confusion about women's roles and loyalties. It was a time of openness and experiment and curiosity, of leaving yourself open to new ways of thinking. And of course, it takes its place in my story in that way.
Was he the love of your life?
I don't answer the question. I've had many loves in my life, and my grandchildren are now the love of my life.
Joan Bakewell, thank you very much for being with us. Oh, and I have to mention that the autobiography, The Centre of the Bed, is going to be Book of the Week, starting next Monday.
Indeed it is.
At 9:45. Thanks, Joan.